This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our first question is from Carol, who emailed in to ask, what passed through the sky at 8:51 last night? Details are on the local news / weather, but we missed the name, etc. And we're really excited about seeing this, but being able to help find out what it actually was. I hope we can help.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it turned out that that was actually the International Space Station. So I checked, and sure enough, there was a space station pass at that time. And in fact, we had a big sort of event really running it through our Twitter feed, through the Jodrell Bank Twitter feed. There was quite a few very bright ISS passes over a period of a week or so. And actually the weather, as it turned out, unusually, was very good across most of the UK, actually. And so we started tweeting a little bit about when the ISS passes were and encouraging people to get out there. And we actually had quite a huge response, actually. I saw there were some beautiful ones visible over Manchester. We saw them in lots of different conditions, lovely clear skies, through thin cloud. The ISS was shining at like magnitude -3, -4, a very, very bright object. So it was really good fun, actually, and there was a lot of response from people on Twitter. We posted a few time-lapse photos that we took as well, which got a lot of interest. And we were able to sort of hopefully publicise the ways in which people can find out about when the ISS is visible. But the main ways are the Heavens Above website. And in Heavens Above, which is www.heavens-above.com, you go in and you have to tell the website where you are, basically. So you enter your geographical location, then knows where you are, and then it will actually tell you, for example, the next 10 days worth of bright ISS passes, or even more dramatically, things like iridium flares are quite exciting to look out for. I don't know, have you ever seen an iridium flare?
No, I never have, but I'm going to definitely check out this website.
No, you need to go and have a look. Iridium flares are basically these communication satellites that reflect the sun, just like the ISS does. But what happens is it's a relatively small sort of pool of light that they're reflecting onto the ground. So it's a bit like somebody in orbit with a torch going round, sort of shining this torch pool of light on the ground. And so if it goes past you, if that pool of light goes over you, as you look up in the sky, what you'll see is just this sudden appearance of a bright light in the sky, which is actually just a satellite moving past, and then it fades away again after maybe 20 seconds or something. And the Heavens Above website will tell you exactly where that will appear and exactly at what time. So you can imagine your friends, drag them out of the pub, get them in the street and say, look in that position, see what's going to happen. And there it appears.
Oh, I'll definitely be doing that.
So Heavens Above is a really good thing. But then in the sort of, I guess in the modern world of Twitter, there's a couple of really useful things. One is something called Twist. So TWISST is a Twitter feed at Twist. Which will actually look up your, basically use the information you've given as to your geographical location, and it will then tweet you prior to an ISS pass. So that's very useful. And the other one is a set of feeds called Over Twitter, which is produced by Orbiting Frog, at Orbiting Frog on Twitter. And they're basically a similar thing which combines information from Heavens Above. But again, you'll put in, for example, over Manchester, we'll tell you what's visible over Manchester, over London, and so on and so forth. And we'll put a link into the big list of those as well. And the other interesting thing that happened, actually, during this particular phase of ISS passes was there was a supply craft, one of the Progress Russian spacecraft that had visited the space station and had undocked. So one night when we were out there looking at those the ISS, you could actually see this fainter, bright spot ahead of ISS orbiting the Earth. And when you looked it up, it was actually this Progress vehicle that had undocked earlier that day. So you can not only just see ISS, you can even see the vehicles that are going up there to bring supplies.
Okay, well, Carol, that answers your question. You saw the International Space Station. Next up, we had an inquiry from Philip Lee Rich. He says, the Perseids, we're told, are the dust left behind from Comet Swift-Tuttle along its orbit around the Sun. Most of this dust, according to Wikipedia, is around 1,000 years old. This puzzled me as I was watching out for them the other week. The dust certainly won't be left along the length of its orbit like an explorer carrying a leaky bag of flour in order to mark its path through a forest. In fact, the dust will be blown further and further away from the orbit by the solar wind and radiation pressure, eventually contributing to the zodiacal light, and it's hard to see how any of it could end up in the diametrically opposite end of the comet's 130-year orbit. So how is it that the Perseids can be seen year after year and not just around the time Swift Turtle crosses the Earth's orbit?
Perseids are basically a meteor shower, shooting stars, basically, that we see in the sky, that we see in the middle of August, basically. It peaks in the middle of August. We see many more shooting stars at that time than we would on average during the year. So that's what a meteor shower is. Basically, these sort of dust grains, effectively, that are smashing into the Earth's atmosphere, moving at maybe 20,000 miles an hour, so they heat up, and you see this bright whiz of light along the sky. And funnily enough, I was quite lucky this year because I was in a very dark sky location on holiday, and it was lovely clear weather as well, and I saw many, 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 many Perseids by hanging around until the early hours of the morning and sitting outside in front of the campfire, basically. So it was really, really, really good fun. And just on that point, you know, they're called the Perseids because they, when you see these shooting stars, they appear to sort of radiate from the constellation of Perseus. And all that is it's basically just the relative velocities, basically, the directions from which those meteors are coming relative to the motion of the Earth as it moves around in its orbit. So you'll tend to see these things in the sort of after midnight is when they tend to peak, because it's when the sort of that side of the Earth is heading directly into the dust that's sitting there in space in the latter half of the night, if you can sort of imagine that. In fact, I was sitting watching these things, the Perseids were quite fast meteors that flashed across the sky. Whereas, in fact, there were quite a few other meteors. If you ever spend any time out at night looking at a clear sky, you will see shooting stars. And there were quite a few others that clearly weren't Perseids because they weren't coming from, the direction of Perseus. In fact, the nicest ones that we saw over that few nights around that time were actually almost coming in the opposite direction. And they were actually rather brighter and also rather slower. And if you think about it, it's because when with the Perseids, the Earth's moving into the dust stream. And if the meteor comes from the opposite direction, it's sort of catching up on the Earth. So the speed, relative speeds will be slower. And so actually you got this, you know, rather less of a fast whiz across the sky. You get more of a sort of nice burning thing that heads across the sky. To answer Philip's question in particular, he's right. We now know that these meteor showers are basically dust that's been boiled off effectively off a comet. So a comet's this sort of dirty snowball idea. So a comet sort of comes in close to the sun on its orbit. This particular comet, Swift Tuttle, which is a funny name, but it's named after two people, Lewis Swift and Horace Tuttle, who discovered it in 1862. So this comet comes in close to the sun, it heats up, the sort of icy, what we call volatiles in it, sublimate actually, they turn directly from solid into gas, and that sort of boils off effectively, and it releases this dust into the region around the comet. Now that process probably starts happening from, you know, maybe four or five times farther away from the sun than the Earth, in other words about four or five astronomical units we call it. So in fact, you know, from well out beyond the Earth's orbit, it'll start to sort of produce this dust, right? And then it whips round the sun and back out again. But there's that whole big long arc of its orbit where it's producing this dust off its surface. Swift Tuttle, the one that we think produces the Perseids, or we know produces the Perseids, does have an orbit that's about 130 years, or about 133 years. It was discovered in 1862. It actually was rediscovered when it came back close to the sun again in 1992. So it's not going to be back until 2126. So in fact, it's a while. So it's on this quite long orbit, but it does come, it crosses the Earth's orbit into the, its orbit intersects with the Earth's orbit. Now you've got to sort of imagine these dust grains sort of boiling off this comet, if you like. The dominant component of their speed, the dominant velocity, is actually the velocity of the comet, and so they sort of move along with the comet in its orbit. They'll stay fairly close to the orbit of the comet, but they do come off with lots of variations in the direction at which they come off the comet, lots of variations in the speed, lots of variations in the size and the mass of the grains, and all those things affect the way in which those grains then continue to orbit. And it turns out that for example, perturbations produced by relatively close encounters with Jupiter and Saturn in particular. The as Philip mentions in his comment, the pressure of the radiation from the sun, the interactions with the solar wind. There's various ways in which the orbits of these dust grains are going to be modified. And in fact, it's possible to make a calculation of that. You can actually put these things in, crank a big handle on your computer program that calculates Newton's laws and these other rather more complicated physical effects. The way it's done typically is to adopt what's called a Monte Carlo approach, which is the Monte Carlo comes from where the casino is. So it's like lots of random things. So you basically run your program a million times with slightly different values for all these parameters, and you see what the statistical distribution of the answers is. So you get some feel for the range of possibilities that might come out. And it turns out that actually they do spread around the orbit quite markedly, in fact. So Philip was worried in saying, well, why don't we only see the Perseids around the time that the comet's actually near the Earth? Why do we see it every year through this whole 130-year orbit? And that's actually because these things do spread out around the orbit of the comet. It turns out that, for example, you can actually calculate, imagine these, put these dust grains that have been ejected the last time the comet came near the sun in 1862. And calculate where they would be now. And it turns out those same dust grains we would see intersecting the Earth's orbit, in other words, perhaps being visible as shooting stars, as meteors, over a whole time period from something like the 1950s up to the 2050s. Okay, so they've spread out over quite a large section of the comet's orbit, and in fact, it turns out they've got this sort of periodic nature as well. That's due to perturbations by the giant planets, by Jupiter and Saturn. So some years you'll get more than other years. In fact, it turns out those sorts of calculations, you can sort of do that. You can say, okay, 1862. 133 years before 1862, 133 years before that, and you can keep injecting dust particles every time it comes near the sun for that whole arc near the sun, and then calculate their orbits. And it looks like actually that the main sort of standard level of Perseid meteors may be as much as 25,000 years old. So that's many orbits of the comet, you know, that's many injections of dust. And the whole, you know, the whole stream of dust that spreads around the whole cometary orbit is actually maybe as much as 100,000 years old or even more. So it's quite a long-lived meteor stream, it looks, the Perseids. I mean, the actual orbit of the comet's at quite an angle to the plane of the solar system, the so-called plane of the ecliptic. So it's perhaps quite stable for that reason. So yeah, I would say that it's actually the case that although yes, he's right, they do get perturbed and the path of the comets gets spread, these dust particles that produce the meteors get spread by rather a large amount. It's taking 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 years for it really to spread out hugely to sort of contribute to the background sort of zodiacal light, as he says. But there still will be this significant core of particles that stays quite close to the cometary orbit itself, and hence that's why we see the peak in mid-August as we do.
I lost track now, I was quite fascinated by that answer. The next question is from Nick Bear. He wrote in to say, I gather the universe started from a singularity at the Big Bang and has been expanding ever since. If so, in what direction relative to our galaxy is that singularity? What is happening there? What is between it and ourselves? Is matter still being created there? How far from it have we travelled in the 13.5 billion years? When I hear that the universe is receding from us in all directions, and the further away galaxies are from us, the faster they are receding, I get the impression that we are considered the centre of the universe. I hope these questions do not appear too silly. I would love to have your views. I adore the show, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you, Nick. We adore it too. Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of interesting question that comes up, you know, now and again. Yeah, I mean, there's this idea that the universe started from this so-called singularity at the Big Bang, and that means a point of infinite density where everything's sort of squashed together, and so the amount of mass contained in a very tiny volume gets bigger and bigger and bigger and goes to infinity at a singularity. You could argue, I think, about singularities, and I think, you know, I don't like singularities. It sounds unlikely, doesn't it? We might imagine that maybe something would operate to sort of, something would come in to prevent a singularity perhaps. But let's imagine there's certainly this point in the past at which the density is very high. And yes, the universe has been expanding ever since. Okay. Ask what direction relative to our galaxy is that singularity? Okay. Well, this is a sort of crucial, misunderstanding really of what's going on, because that singularity didn't just happen. So I think it's ruined really by TV programs where they show a picture. Whenever the Big Bang's mentioned, they show a picture of an explosion, right? And it's sort of looking at this explosion from the outside, and they sort of sometimes they even go into reverse and they see this explosion shrinking down, and it shrinks down to a point, and you sort of look at it and go, oh yeah, there's the point from which the Big Bang expanded and everything expanded out. But that's never the case, because of course who's looking at this? We're all part of the universe. We can't sort of sit outside the universe and look at this thing expanding from a point. So the much better way of thinking about this, I would say, is instead of imagining a point in space from which everything expanded, you've got to think about the distances between objects. So you think about the distances between clusters of galaxies that are widely separated. And what happens in the expansion of the universe is that distance increases. So you could imagine, in fact, the best way to think about it, think about the universe perhaps being infinite. The universe might actually go on forever. We really don't know the answer to that yet. But the universe might go on forever. It's filled with all these galaxies, and the distance between those galaxies changes. So as we go forward in time, the distance between them increases, and the universe is expanding. But the universe itself goes on forever. It's infinite. Wind the clock back, and the distances between those galaxies become smaller, and the galaxies become closer and closer together. But because the universe sort of goes on forever, out in every direction you might want to think, there's no one place towards which they're all moving. So there's no one point at which there was the Big Bang happened. So in fact, the Big Bang happened as much in Nick Beer's kitchen as it happened here in our Jodcast recording studio, which is a very grand name, by the way, for where we actually are. But anyway, the Big Bang happened everywhere. And so that really perhaps gets round a lot of perhaps the problems Nick's having with this understanding. And that also gets around his other problem, which is he gets the impression that we're considered as the centre of the universe, which of course would be very, very strange if we coincidentally turned out to be at the centre of the universe. There is no centre to the universe in that picture. Okay. So although we look out into space and we see galaxies moving away from us, if we were sat in on a planet orbiting a star in any one of those other galaxies and we looked around us, we would also see every other galaxy moving away from us. And the classic picture to imagine that is the sort of currant cake or something in the oven, where the raisins or the currants in the cake are the galaxies, and the cake mix is the space. And what happens is when you put it in the oven, it all expands and the raisins all move away from each other. And if you were sat on any one of those raisins, feeling a bit warm, in the oven, you would see all the other raisins moving away from you. And it wouldn't matter which raisin you picked, all the other raisins would move away from you. It doesn't mean you're at the center of the cake. If that makes sense. You've got to imagine the cake's infinite, you've got a big oven, but hopefully that picture works. Am I throwing you here with my random cake pictures?
I'm just imagining like infinite cakes, yes. Raisins, just going on there, yeah.
Take a long time to eat it.
There'll be some scone though, wouldn't it?
It would indeed.
We have another cosmological question from Russ Jenkins. If I understand it correctly, you are not able to give an estimate to the real size of the universe, only an estimate to the furthest objects it will ever be possible to see, given the age of the universe, the speed of light, and a bit of adjustment for inflation. But we do have models for the Big Bang going right back to microsecond after the event, so surely we think we know what size it was then, also its total mass and total energy content. At what point do we lose track and stop being able to even estimate these things?
Okay, that's a good question. I mean, I guess the physics that we understand, the astronomy that we believe we understand, we think we know the sorts of processes that would be going on to actually back to a good small amount of time after the Big Bang. So we can see back to about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. This is where the cosmic microwave background was produced. It's when the universe had expanded out to a point where the density got to a point where the protons and the electrons actually managed to combine, to form hydrogen. That meant that all the photons that were flying around in the universe at the time weren't scattering off the electrons anymore, and the universe became transparent. So it's a bit like the universe was sort of like a dense fog at early times. And the fog thins out, and basically then you're able to see right across the universe. The universe becomes transparent. That happened about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. But although we can't see directly using photons to times earlier than that, we believe we understand the physical processes. We know enough about physics and the way particles interact to understand the processes that would have been going on even earlier than that. We can certainly go back to times of minutes and seconds after the Big Bang, when all the processes occurred that produced the light elements, so the hydrogen, the helium, that was produced after the Big Bang. There's a famous book called The First 3 Minutes, which is worth looking at, which talks about those first 3 minutes and what happened in that process. But as you go farther and farther back in time, earlier than, say, the first few seconds, then what's happening is the density in the universe is getting higher and higher. The temperature's getting hotter and hotter. The energies, therefore, are getting higher and higher. And it gets to the point where there's a point at which we've not been able to probe the physics using, for example, the large colliders and particle accelerators on the Earth. We haven't got to those energy scales yet. And so there's a point at which we might have theories about the way those particles should interact and should behave, but we haven't been able to test them directly in the laboratory. And so things start to become more uncertain. And actually, it turns out that the classical time at which we say that we've got no idea what happens before that time, it's actually a very small time, a very short time. It's called the Planck time. And the Planck time is about 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Okay, so 10 to the minus 43 seconds is 0.42 zeros and a 1 seconds after the Big Bang. So this is quite a long way back, actually. But let me explain what significance the Planck time. Basically, what it is it represents a time at which we think the conditions are such that it's impossible to disentangle quantum effects from gravitational effects. And although there's been a lot of progress made in physics about unifying the various forces, strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, electromagnetism, one of the things that we're still missing and there's progress being made, but we're still really missing it, is a good theory of combining gravity with those forces too, a good quantum theory of gravity. And so you can sort of imagine one way of looking at how to estimate that Planck time is to say, okay, if you had a particle of a certain mass, you could ask what's its quantum mechanical size, and that's something called its Compton wavelength. And you could also ask what size would it be in order for it to be sort of inside its own event horizon, for it to be a black hole. And it turns out that by making those two sizes the same, its quantum mechanical size and the size of it being a black hole, you can get basically a Planck mass and a Planck length. The mass is actually about a microgram, actually, but the length is tiny. It's about 10 to the minus 35 meters. Very tiny length, 10 to the minus 35 meters is again 0.34 zeros and a 1 meters. So you can imagine taking that microgram, roughly, and sticking it inside a volume that small, you get a very high density, and that time at which the universe had that density is about the Planck time, which is about 10 to the minus 43 seconds. And so, you know, Russ asks about, you know, models of the Big Bang going back. Yeah, we do go right back to microseconds after the event. The Planck time looks like the time at which, you know, we're really struggling to go any farther beyond that. He asks about the total mass and the total energy content. Yeah, we do have a good idea of that. He does say, what do we think the size of the universe was then? Of course, that relates back to the question we just had. Well, the universe might actually be infinite, so it doesn't really make sense to ask how big the universe was. So when people say, oh, the universe was the size of a grapefruit, or the universe was the size of a pea or something at some point in the past, I think what they're really saying is how big the observable universe was. So it's the bit of the universe we can see now that we've had time to see since the Big Bang, that light has had time to arrive to us from since the Big Bang, is a certain size. The universe itself might be infinite, but we see a section of it surrounding the Earth we call the observable universe. We can ask what size that was at these various times. And yeah, way back down at the Planck time, it was sort of like that the observable universe would have been basically less than a Planck length, less than about 10 to the minus 33 centimetres.
Our final question this month is from Ankik, who writes, "Dear sir, I have opted to study electronics and communications branch of engineering. Can you please tell me whether it has any scope in astronomy? How can I then build my career in astronomy after engineering?"
Okay, again, a really good question from Ankit, and in fact, that, you know, it's important to say that, you know, when we talk about astronomy, we're often, you know, talking about the things you've just been talking about, like the size of the observable universe, or, you know, the Big Bang, or how stars live and die, or something. But in fact, for us to make progress in any of that, in any of our thinking about how the universe works and our understanding of our place within it, then we need the instruments to do that. And so, you know, if you were a theoretical astronomer, you might say, oh, you know, I don't even know where in particular star is that I've been working on. You might never have looked through a telescope, but you'd still need probably a computer to do those calculations. So you're reliant on somebody who's been able to build you a fast computer to allow you to do really complex calculations. Obviously, for most astronomers, many astronomers are observational, so they rely on telescopes, and we work very closely, side by side, shoulder to shoulder with engineers all the time. When we've got, an astronomer might have an idea, they might want to test a particular theory, they might want to say, it would be absolutely great to be able to study that period of the universe when the universe became transparent, when the microwave background was emitted, and when the first stars began to form and the first galaxies, were made. How are we going to do that? And actually, we might have ideas about what radiation might be produced and how bright it might be, for example. But we'd need an engineer to come to us and say, okay, you know, to see that, we'd need this sort of technology. We need a telescope this size. Is that possible? We go to the engineers say, actually, you can't do that. It's too heavy. Or, well, if we made it out of this material, maybe that would work. Or we'd need this sort of instrument in order to detect that type of radiation. And so it's a very, very close relationship. So you do see many jobs in astronomy, relating to astronomy, which are for engineers. And let me give you a very specific example which relates to Jodrell Bank, which is our new eMerlin telescope. eMerlin is a network of six radio telescopes spread across the UK. If we include the Lovell telescope, that's seven radio telescopes. Those telescopes are combined together to work as one. The process that's involved in getting the radio waves that arrive at the telescopes to produce a final radio image is a long and involved process, and it involves many areas of engineering. Not only do you have to build those physical structures, those dishes, to the right size and the right shape, the dishes have to be the correct parabolic shape and so on to focus the radio waves to the focus. The radio waves then have to be turned into an electrical signal by a receiver. Those receivers are cooled down to about 20 degrees Kelvin, or even lower sometimes. So how do you do that? What's the engineering involved in cooling something down to that temperature? It's refrigeration, it's cryogenics. You've got to turn that into electrical signal. You've got to bring that down. You've got to change the frequency of those electrical signals. There's a lot of analog electronics involved in that. Very precise, precision engineering. We have engineers that build those receivers for us here at Jodrell Bank. In the case of eMerlin, what then happens is those electrical signals are turned into an optical signal, because what eMerlin does is it brings back all the signals from the remote telescopes on optical fibres. So you've got to turn an electrical signal into an optical signal, and you fire those photons of light down an optical fibre all the way, you know, across the UK. When they get back to Jodrell Bank, they've got to be turned back into an electrical signal again. Okay, so this is optoelectronics, this process. And then you've got to digitize those signals. We digitize them. So we have very fast samplers that can digitize millions of times a second the strength of that signal. And then those things are combined into basically a specialized computer, a bit of hardware called the correlator, that has to combine them. It has to make correct for the time delays between the times at which the signals arrived at the different telescopes, by comparing that signal with a time signal from an atomic clock. After that point, at some point, eventually astronomers get involved. But there's a huge amount of engineering that's required in order for us as astronomers to sort of make the conclusions we do about the universe. And it's often what's involved in engineering and astronomy is right at the cutting edge of what's capable. As I say, in the case of eMerlin, in terms of high-speed data transfer, and the volume of data transfer is immense, as well as all these very specific and wide-ranging areas of engineering, from structures to optoelectronics to digital electronics and so on. So yeah, there's great scope for Ankit to work in astronomy, and we'll put a link on the website about you know, where you can find out more about that.
Thanks to Carol, Philip, Nick, Russ and Ankit for their astronomical questions, and thanks for Tim for answering them all wonderfully and like enthralling me as well. And if you have any more questions, please get in contact on the website at www.jodcast.net.